Let me turn very briefly to introduce our panellists for this evening. This is where I sort of get to be David Dimbleby. I've never, you know, anybody who compares us age-wise is going to be unpopular for a while. So good evening and welcome. I'm told to say that our panel tonight offers experience, diversity and insight from a range of different perspectives, but I think you'll see that that's exactly right. Paul Applin is a partner at AC Mole and Sons in Taunton, and he's vice president, shortly become deputy president of the ICAW. Among his various roles, he sits on HMRC's Administrative Burdens Advisory Board, which was recently called upon to advise the Treasury Committee on whose MTD costings were made more reliable. HMRCs are the federations of small business. Their verdict, neither was perfect. Paul was awarded an OBE in 2009 for services to the accountancy profession. Jill, somewhere in here.
Rutter.
Oh, sorry, I can't find it. So, sorry, these are out of order, so I'll take these out of order. Stella Amis, on my right, is an international tax partner at PwC and is responsible for the firm's policy, regulation, media and reputation work in relation to UK tax. This means she's been closely involved with the firm's Paying for Tomorrow project on the future of tax, and hopefully we'll hear more of that over the course of this evening. Vanessa Holder, on my left, is probably the most influential journalist currently writing about tax. As the lead tax writer for the Financial Times, her beat covers everything from business rates to BEPS. Just over a year ago, she said that, every year I think, golly, this is the year it's all going to get boring. But it never has so far. I'm guessing, at least hoping, that still hasn't changed. John Cullinane is the COT's tax policy director, a role he took on in 2015 after retiring as a partner at Deloitte. John was, of course, Institute President himself back in 2006-07, when in his inaugural speech, he likened tax complexity and uncertainty to a drug to which the government was addicted. 11 years on, this is a habit which I fear has yet to be kicked. Perhaps there is a treatment for the addict. The Better Budget Report, of which John, along with our fifth panellist, Jill Rutter, is co-author, is a detailed prescription for a more considered, consultative, long-termist approach to tax policy making. I'm sure we'll hear more about that as we go on. Back in 2006, Jill was Director of Strategy at DEFRA, having previously had various roles at the Treasury, including as Ken Clark's press secretary and the Downing Street Policy Unit. Since 2011, she's been at the Institute for Government, where she directs the Institute's work on better policymaking, arm's-length government, and Brexit. And in case that wasn't enough to keep her busy, she's also an advisor to Full Fact, who independently fact-check the things our politicians and others say. I am absolutely amazed she's got time to do anything else at all. So that's our panel. So the way in which we will do this is that we're going to have a number of topics. After each round of topics, I'll ask the panel to comment on a few questions, and then after each round, I will throw it open to the floor. We have a number of people in the audience with microphones who will be coming down. Please do put your hand up. I would ask you, when you do ask a question, two things. First, please say who you are before you start. And can I please ask, we only have an hour and a quarter, so if you could please ask a question and not make a speech, that would be very much appreciated. I will play like David Dimbleby. If you're making a speech, I'm going to stop you, just to make myself popular after 1 hour in the job. So, let me start. Probably one of the most serious issues facing the world of tax at the moment is the digitalization of the tax system. So Paul, let me start with you. Do you think that the dropping of the making tax digital clauses from the pre-election finance bill provides the opportunity for a rethink? And if so, what should the government be rethinking?
I think before I answer your question, John, there's just one thing I'd like to pick up from your introduction, and that's that you hope people won't make any comparisons age-wise. I've just come back from a cruise on the Danube. What my wife didn't tell me until we got there was it was a saga cruise. And I was so glad that I declined the saga baseball hat when we disembarked and met the Romanian film crew who wanted to do a quick interview. MTD, I think rumours of its imminent demise just because the clause was dropped from the finance bill are rather hopeful. Of course not. You only have to read what the financial secretary actually said in the debate. She said that the government still believes the future of tax administration is digital. It's going to happen. The other thing she said that I do put some hope in, actually, is that by deferring this to later in the year, Parliament will have a better opportunity to debate MTD, and I think Parliament really does need a decent opportunity to debate this. Can I just say a couple of other things, John? I think there's a perception that MTD is simply something driven by HMRC. I think there's a huge force in the marketplace as well. Software is developing at a pace that I don't think any of us have ever witnessed in our careers. Apps are developing very fast. And I'm seeing firms of all sizes, from Big Four down to sole practitioner, embracing new technology in ways and to do things that perhaps even 3 or 4 years ago we couldn't have dreamt of. The market is forcing change just as much as MTD. MTD is a catalyst, but it's one of many. So where do I hope it'll go, John? My view, I think, is fairly well known. I'm completely in favour of using digital technology to improve tax administration. Who wouldn't be? It would be crazy not to seize the opportunity digital offers us. But I'm adamantly against mandation. If this is built right, people will want to use it. I've got concerns. The Treasury Committee had concerns. The House of Lords Economics Affairs Committee had concerns about burdens for smaller businesses. When Parliament gets to debate this later in the year, I really hope that not only are they going to listen to those who are trying to push the agenda, whether in HMRC or in the profession, and I'm one of the ones who wants to see this succeed, but I hope they'll also listen to the concerns. Yes, there was widespread support for MTD. There was also widespread concern for smaller business. That needs to be listened to as well. So MTD is still on the road. For me, I think the real task now is let's get involved in the pilot. Let's see how well the technology works. Let's show HMRC just how granular all this is, because I think anyone who's a practitioner knows that it's the granularity that's going to be the problem. If we're going to get the software working, the apps working, the digital underpinning of all this working, we've got to make the pilot work. And if we make the pilot work, we'll also know the answers to the questions that have been troubling everyone. What's this going to cost? What are the real burdens? And what are the real benefits? We can finally get away from guesstimates based on a system that doesn't exist to some facts drawn from a system that does.
Thank you. Vanessa, I'm particularly interested in, as a journalist, what you hear about this, and whether I suppose you think that, you know, with the election, there is an opportunity for a campaign to sort of build within Parliament, given the Treasury Select Committee, to sort of cause government to do a rethink, or whether you think they're so committed to this that it's going to move unchanged regardless.
It strikes me that one of the big problems with this is the lack of awareness of it. It's not an issue that people seem to be on people's agenda, and I just can't see it taking off in an election campaign. I mean, there is a difference between the parties. I think Jeremy Corbyn said that he'd like everybody with turnover under 82,000 to be exempt, but it doesn't strike me as one of those issues that they're going to make a big deal out of. So I rather think not, which is a pity, because, you know, as Paul said, there are a lot of issues here and there's a lot of things that need to be thought out. And when you talk to people, I mean, I guess everybody's been sort of seeing what small business think of this, and I've only spoken to a few people, but the feedback I get is very mixed. You know, all the way from somebody who thinks, yes, it will force me, as a Pilates teacher said, it will force me, you know, to really get on top of things, just as HMRC wants them to do, to a barrister I was talking to last week, who said, there are two sorts of people in the world. You know, there's people like all these tax professionals who, you know, get their tax returns in nice and early and, you know, like the idea of being very organised and think this idea of having software that will force people to be very organised is a thoroughly good thing. And then there's everybody else, and everybody else gets in their tax returns on the 31st of January and they will bitterly resent being made to do this sort of thing, you know, more than once a year. So it is going to be very difficult, and it's a pity we're not going to get more of a debate on it, but I suspect we're not.
Stella, a lot of the discussion is about sort of small businesses for very understandable reasons. Do you think that there are impacts on big businesses from what you're seeing in areas where actually larger businesses are concerned because of the complexity of their affairs?
I think when it comes to big businesses, generally at the moment, clearly they're very concerned about what's happening in the environment altogether. The impact on small businesses does have a real direct impact on big business because small businesses are in the supply chain, so that's important for them. But I think I'd pick up on one of the points that Paul mentioned. Digitalisation is coming, and it comes for everybody. It isn't just an issue for small business. Clearly, the spotlight is there now. But for big business, they have similar issues, and you know there's lots of different areas where we're already doing real-time reporting. One of the examples that we saw was in Spain. I think they're now real-time reporting their invoices before they even issue the invoices to customers. So businesses know this is coming, and it's going to be a challenge for everybody. And the issues that we're talking about at the moment, I think Paul's absolutely right. The pilot is so important, and the fact that we get that right, it makes such a big difference, not just to making it work, but the debate that we have around it. And I think big business will be engaged in that debate, even though it isn't affecting them directly at the moment.
I mean, Jill, from your experience, you know, you've seen an awful lot of, you know, Whitehall big projects. This is another Whitehall big project. Do you think that there are things from your past experience that government might learn in how they're running MTD and what they might do going forward?
So just a few thoughts. I'm not our digital expert, with all those other things I have to do, enough time for that. I think it's quite interesting. We did a case study, for example, of the rollout of automatic enrolment, and what was quite interesting in there was a conscious decision to stage the rollout over a large number of firms, but start with the largest firms, the most easy to comply, iron out the problems, and then as that works, sort of map in other firms. So it's quite interesting to start from the other end. I think there's an interesting thing in MTD with actually scoring the savings too soon, which dictates the timetable, because actually one of the things you shouldn't do is do big scale innovation and also sort of assume it's working and score that revenue in. And of course, fiscal arithmetic for some score savings on MTD. It's quite interesting if you look at everything saying digitalisation is coming. So one of the projects in which government fell on its face was digitalising rural payments, because actually rural broadband just wasn't good enough to cope with farmers filing for the single farm payment online, and they had to actually revert to manual payment. And that was actually the subject of some very, very acrimonious exchanges between the Government Digital Service and the Rural Payments Agency is responsible for that. Just a final point, though, if you think about HMRC, Brexit, which I think we might discuss later, means that the absolutely critical thing to get in time is actually not MTD, it's the new big customs system that needs to actually be available for Brexit. And so if you're looking at digital projects and HMRC's digital bandwidth, that has to actually take priority, because if not, that's a real cliff edge.
Thank you. And John, I suppose just on a slightly broader theme, in their book, The Future of the Tax Profession, Richard and Daniel Susskind argue that the tax profession is at particular risk from computerisation. And they talk about the risk not just to compliance work, but to just about everything we do. I suppose the blunt question is, do you think any of us will have a job in 10 years' time?
Well, I think when I first started in tax, part of the kind of review process for preparing tax returns, if somebody made a change on review, the whole thing had to be sent to be retyped. I mean, the numbers were just the equivalent of letters. There were no spreadsheets. So there was a whole activity, you know, checking those, you know, when they came back from the typist. So, you know, as technology moves on, there are always some things made redundant. I mean, there's a broad thing, I think, that the more difficult and challenging tax is, the more there will be a role for agents. But the big proviso of that is the agents have to be very adaptable. And the sort of world where there was very old technology, and where, you know, come to that, the law was simpler and you knew what it was at any one time instead of half of it going to be, you know, enacted retrospectively, etc. Or you didn't have to worry about your reputation because as a client, because nobody cared what you did in tax. All those sort of things have become more difficult, but that requires the agent to advise from a broader perspective and to change their act a bit and to get with the new technology. I must say, when I first started in the role, the vibes you would get from the membership was a little along the lines that MTD was all a bit of a plot to kind of cut the agent out. as the debate's gone on, the discussions I've had, you know, with small practitioners groups and so on, it's very much changed to, oh my God, I don't know how the clients are going to cope with this, but, you know, much more, as it were, confident about their own role. So, you know, that's how I would see it.
And before I throw it open, I would just make a shameless plug that I genuinely believe that in the world of the future, it is those tax professionals who have the highest skill set and the greatest level of training who will actually thrive. And that's a blatant plug for the CTA, if ever I heard one. Let me open that subject of digitalisation up to the floor. We have people with mics. Could you please put your hand up and please say who you are?
Andrew Turnbull, I was a member of the Economic Affairs Committee in the House of Lords, which has looked at this thing. I have to say, we were absolutely aghast at the extent to which this thing wasn't adequately prepared. There are something like 3 million businesses potentially who could be affected by this. The consultation process has not got through to millions of people, but a few thousands. The things we were really sceptical about were the costs. Do the panel really believe that this can all be done for an average of £280? Secondly, do they believe that this is actually inversely related to the complexity of the business, that the people who are pretty digitally sophisticated already will actually cost them less, and the smaller businesses, right down to £10,000, will end up paying more? Does the panel really believe the figures for the extra revenue this is going to generate, the 600 or maybe 900 million a year, simply by virtue of the fact that people are putting in these records in a different form? Because when we talk about exemption in VAT, as I understand it, the exemption is actually you're exempt from the tax. The exemption that we're talking about here is not, you're still going to pay the tax. The question is, are you exempt from putting in 4 returns a year or probably 5, because you could put one in at the end? So do you really believe the numbers on which this is all based in terms of the costs and in terms of the money it's going to bring in?
Thank you. I'll take a couple of questions and we'll take them all together. Any other questions anybody wants to raise at this stage? Mike.
Mike Thexton. My question, which is brought into sharper focus by what Jill Russ has just said, is whether we actually think that HMRC can make it work. We have at the moment part of the existing tax system, which has worked reasonably well for quite a number of years, that if you file online with a certain combination of dividend income and other income, the HMRC computer calculates your tax wrong. Now that's for 2016-17, because they have made the tax system more complicated with the dividend allowance. And I think quite apart from the problems of how much it will cost and whether people will be able to do it, I just don't believe that HMRC will be able to deliver a system that works. I was quite shocked to see when I tried to file my own tax return, not with the final figures, I hasten to add, but it said, according to our records, you have an income contingent student loan. Is this true? And I thought, how young do they think I am? That
Take
sort of thing. That,
it's
shaken my faith in the system. So, I mean, do you think, I'm going to ask a question, do you think that this will actually be something where HMRC or the government, whichever government it is, suddenly has a reality check sometime between now and next year and will realise it's not going to work?
Anthony.
Anthony Thomas. Just an observation, really. I think that it's really important that we understand that this is definitely going to happen. I think we should be encouraging it. My biggest worry is that the costs are not truly reflected on the burden that we're going to have as practitioners to deal with it. I think it's an amazing opportunity for the tax profession here, but we need to tell our clients this pretty soon, I think, because they don't genuinely know what's going on here, and I think there will be backlash into government if that doesn't happen.
So let me take all of those. I mean, Pahul, again, perhaps if I can start with you, Do you think that the estimated cost for clients is being reasonably set out? And is it going to be disproportionately hitting the smaller business?
It's why I really put so much store in the pilot, because I think until we have the pilot running with real software and real apps, and let's bear in mind the APIs have only just been released to the software developers. Let's bear in mind the pilot is only just getting off the ground with a fairly small number of people. It's only when that pilot gets up and running that we're going to see what the real costs and the real benefits are. I've been in practice for 36 years. Do I really believe the costs are as low as you stated? No, I don't. I find it inconceivable, but I'd rather not try and put a cost on it because, again, I'd be trying to predict the cost of a system that doesn't yet really truly exist. So I think that the pilot is really important. If you look at HMRC's revised figures, as an accountant, I like looking at break-even and payback. If you look at the revised figures, the payback period is years out, and that assumes that you only have to buy the hardware once. Well, how many times do I have to change this thing? I don't think I keep it for 5 years, and 5 years is shorter than the payback period. So I do have some doubts. Anthony, I completely agree with everything you say. I act for a lot of very small businesses, a lot of micros. I'm very concerned about how they adapt to this. My biggest concern is training and the learning process. My experience over 3.5 decades of this is, yes, you can get people digital. I've taken hundreds of clients through that process, but you can't do it in a short time. You have to invest time, you have to invest effort. Probably my biggest concern is, do we have the capacity to actually go through the training process we need to get our clients there on the current timescale? I don't think we do. Do I think the timescale is going to stretch? Absolutely. But I don't think HMRC would want to say that yet. But again, it's the pilot that will take us there.
And John, I mean, you know, I Vanessa's point was that, you know, this isn't yet really at the forefront of people's minds. Do you think as a profession we're doing enough to start to make sure our clients are aware, the smaller clients are aware of what's coming?
Well, I think we have to be a bit careful, you know, as professional institutes, not to be seen to be kind of stirring up popular discontent against a kind of government policy, particularly when, you know, the general direction, I think we're all agreed, is probably the only viable one. So I think we have a balancing act. On the other hand, you know, bodies such as the Federation of Small Business, which, you know, is quite a legitimate job to do to promote that kind of thing, and others are trying to make people aware. But, you know, it's like anything else. It's very hard to predict at what point the penny will drop with the general public and the kind of mainstream political world that this is coming. I mean, I think the real problem is around mandation and, as Paul says, the tight timescale, because, you know, any organisation represented here, whether it's small or large or a professional institute, will be spending a fortune on IT compared to what it was spending 10 years ago. Or quite a poor person in quite a poor country might have a mobile phone bill, which they didn't have, you know, 10 years ago. And they all do that because they've voluntarily seen benefits in organising their lives that way that outweigh those costs. And what I think is, you know, going to cause the problem, unless it's relaxed, is forcing people into this direction at a great pace, so they perceive it as entirely cost and downside and hassle. You know, one just hopes the penny drops about that at some stage. It's the mandation and timescale that, you know, create the real problem. The costs are just very hard to estimate, and as Paul said, until you've done pilots, you just won't really know.
I mean, Jill, I think everybody in this room would agree this is going to happen. I don't think there's any realistic prospect the government is going to stop this process now. But there has to be a very real risk that there will be a problem as a result of this, whether it's computer-based or whether it's just reaction from the... So, Jill, do you think that there is likely to be a problem? And if so, just how significant an issue do you think that's going to be?
I think other people are better placed than me to say is there going to be a problem, but one of the things I would say is that the classic criticism of every big government project is that they suffer from optimism bias. The NAO has written, National Audit Office has written lots and lots of reports on that, which means that people start off with extremely optimistic timescales, and then those timescales slip. So you look at Universal Credit. Universal Credit was supposed to be fully operational by the end of the 2015 Parliament. It's now 2022, and every time as a new Secretary of State comes in, it gets moved back a couple of years. So I think we undoubtedly will get there in the end. I think there's a very interesting question of when do we get there. But I think what it does show is a really interesting thing about why the way the government sets up and conceives these big projects, that actually you get sort of these sorts of conversations happening quite well into the process, rather than actually setting the thing up from the start to co-develop and co-design it with the people who are going to have to use it, which seems to me a much better way of going about doing something, which is a sensible change to make, but one where actually I wouldn't, you know, I don't know whether the revenue effects or timing effects, they presumably managed to convince the OBR to put their thumbprint on it, Andrew, but Andrew's my first boss, so have to defer to him, but so someone somewhere thinks they're right. They may just be bringing payments forward slightly rather than, you know, having to chase them a bit. But I think this is a question of sort of more haste, less speed. Actually, if you do much more investment in the start of setting the project up right, you're likely to have a plausible project that you can bring in on time and to budget, rather than go the wrong way around it and just delay.